Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hey, how you doing? And welcome to the show this week. And due to popular demand, we've decided to replay some of our favorite interviews and segments from the last several months here on the Kelly Alexander Show. It's been so much fun to wade through our archives and pull out the pieces that you've asked to hear one more time. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy listening to these amazing guests, as well as our wild segments that we've had so much fun to put together for you right here on the Kelly Alexander Show.
Your need for sound.
If you have a pet, you know how important they are to the family. It's like having another child running around. And it's important to treat your furry kid as best you can, and that includes proper medical care. Our next guest can help you do that, even if you're on a budget. Dr. Robert Ridgway is a veterinarian and author of the book, How to Treat Your Dogs and Cats with Over-the-Counter Drugs. Dr. Ridgway, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Perfect. Now, Dr. Ridgway, why did you actually write this book, you know, Treating Animals with Over-the-Counter Drugs? I think maybe for some people that might seem maybe scary or negligent to some people,
yeah,
thinking that they wouldn't go see a veterinarian.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, the thing that I do in the book is to encourage everybody, number one, to go see the veterinarian. But the problem I have learned is that there are two groups of people. Number one, there are folks who are never going to take their pet to see a veterinarian. I don't care how traumatic or how bad the pet is, they will not take their pet to see a veterinarian. Secondly, I have friends who would like to take their pet to see a veterinarian, but they just cannot afford to do so. So they're not going to go either. And the third reason I wrote the book is that I know that people are using over-the-counter drugs to treat their pets. And I looked up one of the toxicology websites, and I found that several hundred animals had been treated for with ivermectin, and that either killed their pet or made it very, very sick. And there are other compounds that people are buying over-the-counter and treating their pets with, and they don't know the dose to give or how long to give it. And so I thought that I could help people that I felt that had kind of been ignored by my profession, because it's not a profitable circumstances for them to do so. Does that make sense?
It definitely makes sense. And I wanted to ask you if you could explain to us about the book itself and how it works.
So the way the book works is that at the beginning of each chapter, there's, of course, it tells you what's in that particular chapter. But, for example, the topic, like cleaning ears, then it gives you how to do that and what you need to do. And or dogs fetching balls and the treatment and what you need to do if a ball gets stuck in the throat, you know. And so what we do is explain what the situation is, and then how you can treat it. And if there's a medication, it gives the dose, daily dose, how many days to give, and where you can go to purchase that product.
Wow, that's fantastic. I think that's amazing. That really is sort of laying everything out step by step for everyone. And I guess, you know, is there a lot of ailments that can actually be treated, Dr. Ridgway, by over-the-counter drugs, you know, for these cats and dogs?
Well, you know, I have 103 items in book number one, which is called How to Treat Your Dogs and Cats with Over-the-Counter Drugs. And I have 63 in How to Treat Your Dogs and Cats with Over-the-Counter Drugs Companion Edition. So that's, 166 different things that either can be treated or prevented if you read the book and know what to do and how to do it. And so if you prevent it, you don't have the expense of medication. I hope that makes sense.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess, what are some of the most common diseases, you know, in dogs and cats, and what are the symptoms to be on the lookout for?
Well, that's kind of a loaded question, because it can be a lot of things, and every person will probably give you a different answer. However, let's start by just having dirty ears can result in an infection of the ears and head tilt. And so the idea here is to, you just need to look at the ears and make sure that they're clean. And normally to determine that they're dirty, you can see some black stuff in the ear. And if you see that, then there's probably some gunk in there or some ear mites. And if that's ignored, you can have an ear infection, and then you have to have medication. It may result in a real need to see your pet's doctor. But if you're on top of it, you keep the ears clean. I tell you how to clean the ears in the book. And so it's super simple, and it's things that you can purchase right over the counter at a grocery store or Walmart or at a pharmacy, and it's very easy to do. Eyes, sometimes, you know, dogs get dry eyes, and all you need to do is put artificial tears in the eye. But I have seen so many dry eyes that that people have not made an effort to do anything, that I felt like I need to write about this, because you can go to the pharmacy, Walmart, grocery stores, and find artificial tears and put in the eyes, and the eyes will clear up instead of being cloudy and having all that gunk around the eyes, and they just look really nice. Now, there are other things that cause eye problems other than dry eyes. Well, you can tell dry eyes normally because, you know, the eye is kind of dry and you get all this gunk around the eye. And the thing that's spooky about eyes, it's really easy to have an eye today and it's gone tomorrow. And so if you put artificial tears in the eye and it doesn't clear up right away, they need to see the pet's doctor to make darn sure that they're doing the right thing. I had a fellow call me from Oklahoma, and he went to a veterinarian and they diagnosed a fungal condition. And so he treated the fungal condition according to the book, and he called me and told me what he was doing. He was really excited about the book and how this, you know, the disease was resolving. And it's a pleasure to get stuff like that. Now, toenail trimming, a lot of people will trim their pet's toenails and they cut them too short and they start bleeding. And if they use some cornstarch, they can stop the bleeding. You know, if you just prepare before you clip the toenails, have your cornstarch available because you're probably going to clip it, then it's real easy. I've had one person tell me, he says, my gosh, I clipped the dog's toenails and it bled all over the kitchen. He didn't know what to do. Another one, people are trying to be kind to their pet and they're feeding an all-meat diet. But the problem with an all-meat diet is the calcium-phosphorus ratio is way off, way off. It should be 1 to 1.1, 1.2. phosphorus to calcium. But when you use an all-meat diet, you have a high phosphorus and a low calcium. And the body will maintain the blood calcium level. And if you were going to guess, where does an animal or a person have calcium that he can mobilize to keep the blood calcium level normal? And you have to think, oh, the bones. And so the next thing you know, the bones are paper thin, and they start breaking. And people wonder, how is my dog? He didn't get hit, but he's got broken bones. The other thing that they develop dandruff, and called pityriasis, and you have all this flaking of the skin, and oftentimes they have diarrhea. And Mark M. Morris Jr. found that if he fed an all meat diet for 3 months, it would kill a dog.
Wow.
And so it's important that you, people think about cereals and so forth and feeds. Now, the thing is, this was back in the early 70s, and the FDA has gotten more. The Food Drug Administration has got more into pet foods that found in snowstorms and stuff like that. People are eating these dog foods. So they got more involved in this, and there's more of a cognate of providing a proper diet for our pets now due to that, you know. I can go on here. Petting-induced aggression in cats. You can start petting a cat, and all those, and if you pet it, and it'll bite you. And that's called petting-induced aggression in cats, and really all you got to do is just pet the cat a little bit and stop, leave it alone, and you won't get bit. But when your friends come over, you tell them, don't pet the cat. Guess what they're going to do? They're going to pet the cat until they get bit.
Yes, that's true. And I wanted to ask you as well, speaking of cats and dogs, and something that I think happens to a lot of dogs particularly is if they get sprayed by a skunk. How would you deal with that, Dr. Ridgway?
Well, you know, it's interesting. They had a chemist come up with the materials for this, and it's rather simple. What you do you just need a clean bucket or a large bowl, and then you mix in the bottle of a small container because the ingredients are very active, and you add 1 quart of hydrogen peroxide to 1 quart of water, and you add 1/4 cup of Arm & Hammer baking soda, and a teaspoon, 1 or 2 teaspoons of any liquid soap, any liquid soap, and you mix it with a plastic utensil. You protect the eyes of the dogs. You can put some ointment in it, artificial tears or whatever, or put your hand over it. And I would suggest that you use rubber gloves or something like that for yourself. And you just pour it on the animal, and that'll help the smell tremendously. I guess so. You have a lot of skunks up there in Canada?
Yeah, well, they seem to be all over the place in general. And I know when I lived in Toronto, there was some there as well. So I think it's probably a North American issue to deal with. Joining us on the show is veterinarian Dr. Robert Ridgway, author of the book, How to Treat Your Dogs and Cats with Over-the-Counter Drugs. Dr. Ridgway, how important is it to recognize the signs that your pet may need professional help and not to play doctor yourself?
I think it's most important. And I say in the book that the number one thing, the best thing to do, is always to take their pet to the veterinarian, because they're trained to make a diagnosis, and they know what to treat. And what's, for example, we were talking about eyes earlier. One of the things that can happen in a pet is that, you know, the third eyelid comes across the eye. It can get a foreign body behind there, and you can try and get it out by flushing it or whatever, but that isn't very effective. And if you take it to your veterinarian, he or she can put some medication in the eye, and almost instantly the pain will be gone and will allow them to lift the third eyelid and get that foreign body out of there. And if you leave it there, the foreign body will move back and forth on the eye and cause an ulcer on the cornea of the eye, and you certainly don't want that. So that's a prime example. And the ideal thing is always, always, always to go see the veterinarian. But my problem I found is that people don't go, and they're not going to go. And so that's the reason I wrote the book.
And with regards to dosage, Dr. Ridgway, how important is it for people to follow, you know, these dosing instructions that are in your book? Because I think sometimes people think, oh, a bit more of this and maybe a little less of that doesn't really matter.
Boy, you just hit the nail on the head. And I mentioned that in the foreword of the book, where people think a little bit, if a little bit is good, a whole bunch ought to be better. And that's how you kill your pet or make it really, really sick. Now, I was super concerned about people overdosing their pets and calculating dosages. So what I did, I made charts so that you look at the chart and determine the weight of your dog. And all you have to do is look at the weight of the dog and go across the chart and get the dose that you need to give for, let's say, an internal parasite or something like that, or an external parasite, and it made a difference. And it's super simple. All you got to do is know weight in pounds, and it says dose in cc's. I'm looking at the chart right here in front of me. Give me a weight. Here's a 9.8. A 69-pound dog that needs a dose of 13.8 cc's. I mean, it's just that simple. All you got to do is just know the weight of the dog, look at the chart, and that's it. Because I was super concerned that people would make a mistake in calculating, so I made these charts so there's not going to be any mistake. And if you give the dose that I give in the book, even if you misdiagnose it, you're not going to harm the pet if you use the proper dose. You overdose it or underdose. See, the other thing is that nobody can be there when you or anybody else tries to treat the pet. It is their decision right on the spot to do whatever it is that they're going to do. And you or I have no control over what they do. But if they follow this guide in the book, they're going to be okay. They're not going to have a problem.
Dr. Ridgway, where can people get a copy of this book?
Well, they can get a copy of this book in many places. Amazon.com is probably the most common, and you have to put, just Amazon.com books, and it'll pop up, but it doesn't have pet books that will pop up. They have novels and that type of thing. So you put the title in, at the top. There's a search within the Amazon.com books, and bingo, the books will pop right up. There's two of them, How to Treat Your Dogs and Cats with Over-the-Counter Drugs and the Companion Edition. And you can also go to Barnes & Noble. They will order the book for you, and you don't have to pay the freight. And so you save $2 or $3.
That's fantastic, Dr. Ridgway. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
That's quite all right. My pleasure. Anytime.
Excellent. That is veterinarian Dr. Robert Ridgway, author of the book, How to Treat Your Dogs and Cats with Over-the-Counter Drugs. And again, check it out on Amazon.com.
It's a summertime affair in the atmosphere. I'm a lover, attire and the clothes that she wear. Some of them are bone up, them tires, some of them are draw down gear. Well, some of them are shine up, some are wax up, not a sign of smear. Gotta be rolling in my crystals that the girls them stare. This is Shaggy and Raven as your ultimate beer. Taking care of her career, so tell the world beware. Cause it's a brand new selection for your musical era.
We say we want, and we say what we need.
Caramel skin. I'm a smile at her, she looked at me and gave me a grin. I'm an offered her a drink and she said juice and gin. And as I whispered in her ear, I asked her, how you doing? Where was it that I reside? And I told her Brooklyn. Atmosphere filled with romance, eyes were sparkling. Just her voice and what she said, I let my poor head spin. Ragamuffin shaggy, now with a musical swing. I said, pretty little woman, sexy as can be. Sweet as honey, sing like bumblebee. Shaggy said, pretty little woman, sexy as can be. Pretty little woman, sexy as can be, sweet as honey, sting like bumblebee. It's a summertime appearing at the atmosphere. I'm a lover, attire and the clothes that she wear. Some of them are bundung, them tires, some of them are draw down gear. Well, some of them are shined up, some are wax up, not a sign of smear. Gotta be rolling in my crystals that the girls them stare. This is Shaggy and Raven as the ultimate beer. Taking care of our careers, so tell the world beware. Cause it's a brand new selection for your musical era.
In the summertime,
in the summertime.
As the weather gets warmer in many parts of the world, it inspires people to be outside doing all kinds of things, including firing up the grill. And because May is National Barbecue Month, we definitely need to chat about what luscious creations can be cooked up on the backyard barbecue. To help give us some great ideas and tips on barbecuing is About.com's barbecue and grilling guide, Derek Riches. Derek, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hi, great. It's good to be here.
Derek, now you've tested a lot of grills over the years. What should, you know, we be on the lookout for in a quality grill, and what should we avoid?
Look for simplicity is the first rule, I always say. Anymore, manufacturers are putting so many extras on grills, all sorts of gadgets and gimmicks, and many of them you'll never actually use or really even need. And that just means that something else is going to break or it's going to ruin your grill. So go simple, And go small. There's very large grills out there. If you don't need a big grill, don't spend the money on one. Get something simple, get something basic, something that's going to work. As far as the quality goes, look for solid construction. The best way to tell is to lift up the lid and try and twist it a little bit. Give it a shake. You know, walk all around it. If you're putting your money down on it, then you should be able to kick the tires and kick them pretty hard. So, you know, look for solid construction. Look for heavy materials.
Now, for our listeners who live in apartments or condos or maybe just don't have the space for a large backyard barbecue, what's the best grill option for them?
Well, you know, there's been a lot moving in this direction in the last few years. Gas grill manufacturers, many now make very small, about 300 square inch cooking area, two burner gas grills. So if you can have gas where you're at, these are nice. Typically the side tables will fold down. It'll take up an area about 2 feet by 2 feet. So it makes for a very good option. Many of them are good quality grills, so you can get the full experience. Aside from that, there's a lot of great portable grills out there that'll run on gas, charcoal, or electric now. So the options are there. If you want it, you can get it.
Now, when it comes to, I guess, gas versus charcoal, do you have a preference, Derek?
Well, I am a charcoal person by nature. For me, charcoal has a better flavor and it has a better experience. I mean, if you're going to go out and do the cookout, firing up the charcoal, having that smell, that kind of authentic fire, to me, it makes a much better experience and it produces better food, in my opinion. But, you know, you do have to say that gas is much more convenient. Modern gas grills are just like your indoor cooking appliances. They're reliable and easy to use, and they're very predictable. So if you don't want to invest the time with charcoal, gas is your option to go with.
And what do you tell people, Derek, and I'm giggling just because it came to mind, a friend of mine with regards to charcoal grills. She was always afraid when she was going to light it up that she was going to singe off her eyebrows. So what do you tell people about being safe around the charcoal grill and firing it up?
Well, you know, the old traditional, pour the charcoal in, throw in a gallon of lighter fluid and light it on fire, you know, you just don't have to do that anymore. There's a lot of different ways to actually light charcoal. Everything from small paraffin cubes that just slowly burn and get your charcoal lit to electric starters that you can just plug into an outlet, set down in the coals, and we'll have them burning in a couple of minutes.
Now, in your experience for families with young children running around, are there grills or barbecues that should be avoided, you know, having until the kids are a bit bigger, or do you just need to constantly be monitoring the situation?
Well, you know, it's best to keep an eye on it. This is where your placement is really important. Don't put your grill, you know, in a traffic area. Put it, you know, away from where people are going, where they're running around, so that it's less likely to be bumped into. Aside from that, you know, when you're looking at a grill, see if you can topple it over. That's going to be your biggest, you know, your biggest concern. So, you know, a good solid grill that's going to stand up and not get knocked over or, you know, can't be upturned that way is something to really look for. And, of course, you know, just keeping an eye on it.
Joining us on the show is barbecue expert and backyard chef Derek Riches. Check him out for sure on the website, bbq.about.com. We hear so much about special diets, Derek, and healthy cooking. I guess it depends, you know, exactly what you're grilling, but how healthy is barbecuing?
Well, you know, the biggest concern with grilling is cooking at very, very high temperatures. Charring on meats in particular can form carcinogenic substances. So you want to avoid overcooking. On the other hand, because you're dealing with an open surface, grease is literally allowed to drain away from it. Grilling is actually a lower fat option. You don't have to use a lot of oil on things, and a lot of the fat from meats are going to drain away. So, you know, I think that it's, you know, if you're doing it correctly, it's actually a very healthy way to go.
Okay, and then just to reiterate, though, very important to not get that charring substance on it, though.
Yes, don't burn your food.
Okay.
That's kind of the way to go.
Okay. Now, I think a lot of people get intimidated when they have to head off to the butchers, especially if they don't really have an idea about the way the cut of a meat should go. And then I think some people get scared by the price range and stuff like that. How can we choose the right cut without breaking the bank when you go off to the butchers?
Well, you know, the first thing is to have a good relationship. Talk to the butcher. Talk to them about what you want, what you're looking for. You know, it's their job. They know what they're dealing with, and they can typically point you in the direction of something that's going to be good and not too expensive. There's, you know, when it comes to meat, there's a lot of great options you know, one of my favorites is to look for a good chuck steak or chuck eye steak, which is lower in price. It's not as tender as like a beef tenderloin, but it's got a good flavor to it. And if you just marinate it for, you know, 20 or 30 minutes, it's going to be tender and it's going to be very flavorful.
And actually, a question I would have for you about marinating, does that actually help you when it comes to not overcooking the food because it's already moist? Like, should that give you a good start or does that not even come into play?
Well, you know, as I was saying about the formation of these carcinogens on meats, some studies have shown that marinating meats before you grill them can reduce the formation of these carcinogens by as much as 95%. So I say always marinate. And it doesn't really have to be that complex. You know, the easiest way to marinate something is a bottle of Italian dressing. Just coat that over the meat, let it sit on there. Even 20 to 30 minutes is perfect before you put it on the grill.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, and that's a quick way to get her done if you're trying to marinate. Okay. Now,
yeah.
I think a lot of people, you know, I guess the standard when you think about barbecuing, even though I know a lot of people go above and beyond, is the old reliable hamburger. But I know a lot of people, you know, with all the chefs out there and all the brilliant ideas that sort of come forth, I don't think it's just about the tomato and the lettuce and the pickle anymore. So in your, I guess, opinion, what makes an awesome gourmet burger?
Well, you know, I'm kind of a purist when it comes to burgers. I like it real simple, but, you know, you can do literally anything you can think of. One of the things that I do that people really seem to love is just to stuff a burger. What you do is you make very, very thin hamburger patties. Put whatever you want to stuff in there. Blue cheese is great. Put a second burger patty over top of it. These are very thin and very small. And then just kind of form it together into a patty, put it on the grill. You have that nice melted blue cheese right in the center of it. You can put some bacon in there. You can put anything you want in there.
Now, should people be adventurous, Derek, and try grilling food maybe outside their comfort zone, like, I don't know, cedar plank salmon or something?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's so much you can do, and there's so much information. There's so many great books out there these days. You can grill virtually anything, and I think that, you know, the sad thing is we go out, we buy these grills, and we don't use them that often, and it's just sitting there, and it should be an invitation. You know, whatever you're trying to make, just think about, you know, how can you grill this?
Okay.
There's just so much you can do.
And speaking of grills, I know, you know, immediately people think right away of the meat, like that's, you know, what the grilling is all about. But so many of us, I think, enjoy grilled vegetables. So is there any tips with regards to grilled vegetables? Because maybe there's some that hold up better than others when it comes to grilling.
I don't think there's a vegetable I haven't figured out how to grill yet. But, you know, the great thing about grilling vegetables is you can do it very simply, you can do it very quickly. And that is the answer, is to keep it really quick and simple. You know, for instance, one of my things is I'll just take asparagus, I'll cut off the ends, put it in, soak it in some cold water for about 15 minutes, and just throw it straight on the grill, and just roll it around until it just starts to wilt, and then take it off. You can do that with virtually any vegetable. With softer vegetables, like squash or things like that, just lightly brush with a little olive oil, throw on some salt and pepper, whatever seasonings you like, put it on the grill. As soon as it starts to get some brown marks on it, you want to flip it over and take it off, you know, when it's cooked.
Is there a special way, Derek, to barbecue brochettes? Because I know that, you know, you've got the combination there where you have either cubes of chicken or pork, and then it's mixed in with the grilled vegetable, which obviously in my thoughts, even though I'm not an expert on this at all, I would think the vegetables grill fairly quickly, quicker than that meat.
Well, you know, that is kind of an issue, is that you get different cooking times altogether. So you kind of want to stick to thinner vegetables or vegetables that you don't matter as much how well cooked it really is. I like bell peppers or onions, you know, red onions, things like that. If it's still got some crunch to it, it's, you know, it's good. So if it doesn't get cooked as completely, it's not going to be an issue. The problems with, I see people will string tomatoes on there. Well, they're just going to turn to mush by the time you get the meat cooked. And, you know, squash can have that same sort of problem. So, you know, one solution is to cook the meat and the vegetables separately.
Okay.
So just, you know, and then you can serve it all together.
Now, a friend of mine does this quite a bit. She puts, she's actually cooked potatoes, I guess, like on the grill. And I'm sure obviously a lot of people do this. She does the tin foil thing where I guess it's steaming. Is that something that you suggest and that people should try out?
Well, it's a really easy way to do it because you can just, you know, you can wrap up the potatoes and throw them on there and let them cook, and you don't really have to pay that much attention to them. Don't put them over too high of a heat because it will burn through. And, you know, if you have a really hot grill, you can actually melt foil. But I do lots of potatoes, and, you know, that's a quick and easy way to do it. Another way is to just slice them, into thick wedges and throw them right on the grill. I make up grill fries like that.
Wow, that sounds awesome. I've never seen that. I'm going to have to try this out, Derek. Joining us on the show is barbecue expert and backyard chef Derek Richards. Again, check out his website, bbq.about.com. Derek, for listeners who have been, you know, barbecuing for a while, what's the key maybe to stepping up a backyard party when it comes to grilling and trying to be a little bit different?
Well, you know, if you're having a party, I would say make sure you're prepared first. Have everything ready to go. You know, if you're marinating stuff, have it all set aside so you don't have to spend so much time right there. And then other than that, you know, throwing stuff on the grill, people are just going to gather around. One of the things I love to do, and it's so simple and it's so easy, is to grill slices of pineapple. I'll just soak them with a little rum and a little brown sugar, throw them on the grill. When that rum kind of hits the flame, there's just that little flash of flare-up. People love it, and it's really quite delicious. Throw a scoop of ice cream on it, makes a great dessert.
Wow. And what do you say, Derek, to people, you know, who are going out camping and maybe going to be doing their cooking actually over an open fire? Are there any tips there that people should be aware of to make sure they're cooking their food properly?
An issue with that is that it's hard to tell how done something is if it's too dark. Make sure you've got some light so you can get a good idea of how things look. And keep an instant read thermometer with you so you're making sure that you're getting your foods cooked through. You certainly don't want to end up with undercooked. You don't want to end up with food poisoning while you're camping.
Right. Okay. And is there anything this year that people should be on the lookout as, you know, a hot, you know, trendy backyard barbecue for 2012?
Well, you know, the big thing going on now is infrared grills. This has become there's a lot of different styles, a lot of different technology out there. Like with any other kind of grill, infrared grills can be either great or they can not be great. So, you know, make sure you know what you're looking for. If you want to go with infrared, which gives you that great, very high temperature cooking, you know, for searing steaks and things like that, you know, do a little research first.
Okay, fantastic. Derek, thank you so much for joining us on the show this week. I really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
That's barbecue expert and backyard chef Derek Richards. Again, go to his website, bbq.about.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
In this day and age, if you want to get ahead in your career and even enjoy a more interesting social scene, it's very important that you know how to work a room, meet people, and build relationships. For many of us, this is a very hard thing to do because we identify ourselves as a shy person and not capable of being captain personality. Well, to help us get over this barrier and break free is keynote speaker, best-selling author Susan Rowan, who is also known as the Mingling Maven. Susan, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Oh, Kelly, I'm so delighted to be with you.
So, Susan, I wanted to start off by saying I think so many of us think we are alone when it comes to being shy and uncomfortable in corporate or social settings, but I'm assuming that's not necessarily true.
Oh, it's not even close to being true. And that was what I based a lot of my work on my book about, which is the statistics from the Stanford Shyness Clinic in the 1980s. 80% of us self-identify as shy. Then you go and take a look at it like 13 years later, and it went up to 93% of adults identify as shy. Well, what caused that increase? Technology. So really, if you walk into a room and you're going, oh, I'm not that comfortable, you are normal. You're among the majority.
Wow. Well, that's good to know, because I think a lot of us feel like we are, you know, a fish out of water. And I wanted to ask you, in your mind, just how important is the ability to sort of navigate a room and meet and converse with new people or someone that may be able to help you advance your career? That has to be a very intimidating thing to sort of take on.
It's very intimidating. It's very daunting. First of all, you're not comfortable walking in a room. You don't know who's there, what to say, etc. But it is so crucial. I mean, in all the programs I've done for leadership for various Fortune 120 companies, the reality is the ability to walk into a room and not only make yourself comfortable, but I'm going to give our listeners another way to look at it. Walk in the room with the goal of making other people comfortable with you. That takes the onus off yourself. And when other people are comfortable, they open up, then you're more comfortable. The next thing you know, you're in a conversation. But it's so crucial. It's not just about having leaders have this skill. We all want this skill. Nobody wants to face an event or gathering and not feel adept, comfortable, effective, etc.
What's the first step for someone to start, you know, sort of breaking free of feeling inept at socializing, whether it is at work, you know, or in a social setting? Is it like a mental thing?
Well, part of it is an attitude, but the other part is, and this is, I'm a former teacher, it's about being prepared. So what I like to say to people and my audiences, be prepared before you go anywhere. Think of who might be at that event and what you have in common with them. Now, with the advent of Google and searching and Facebook and events all online, we would have a much better idea of the theme, who might be there. We might even get to see an Evite list. If you take the time to think, oh my goodness, this is who might be there, this is what professions are in, what do I have in common with them, you'll be more prepared. But the second thing I tell people is, don't go anywhere without preparing your own self-introduction. Most likely, Kelly, there's nobody to introduce you at the door to people. So if you know how to introduce yourself, and that would be connected to that specific event because it'll change at different events, you will be more comfortable and confident.
Is it important as well, Susan, to, you know, you mentioned about doing your research and knowing who's going to be there. Is it also important to know the tone of the event? Because, you know, I've been to a lot of corporate settings where, you know, it might not be the place to be discussing work, even though it's a workplace function.
Oh, absolutely. You know, what I say is, if you have a beverage in one hand and an hors d'oeuvre in another, this is not going to be the time to get anyone to sign on the dotted line to buy your services, to give you a job. This is about starting the conversation, developing the rapport, upon which, with further communication, relationships and trust are built. So you have to get an inkling. I mean, if it's a party-ish, even though sponsored by a business, this is not the time. This is just the time to do the meeting, the mingling, the connecting, the making people comfortable with you so that you're memorable to them.
You know, a few moments ago, you mentioned how important it is to sort of have a personal introduction because, like you said, it's not like you're the Queen of England and you're going to be introduced to everyone as you stroll into the room. What is your key points, I guess, to have an introduction ready for yourself so you do feel confident walking in, meeting new people?
Well, this, unlike what a lot of people say about having an elevator pitch, you're not in an elevator. And this is not the time to have 30 seconds to a minute about yourself. Key factors in your self-introduction, it's 7 to 9 seconds. It's a pleasantry. It's not a pitch. The second point is you key it to the specific event. How you introduce yourself at your own company event would be very different than you might introduce yourself at a charity fundraiser sponsored by a client or a friend's company. And the third part is, I got this from my friend Patricia Fripp, who's an executive speech coach, instead of giving your title, that can be so boring, give the benefit of what you do. If you're in real estate, it might be, oh, and I put roofs over people's heads. Give some people a benefit of what you do, said in a very lighthearted way, so that you're giving people enough information to ask the first question. They think they've started the conversation. They're more comfortable, and then you're really in a conversation.
Joining us on the show is keynote speaker, best-selling author, Susan Rowan. Make sure to check her out. Her website, very simple, www.susanrowan.com. Susan, when you march into these corporate events or social settings, what types of topics, you know, should you be armed with? Because as you mentioned, if there's a drink in one hand and, you know, some food in the other, you don't want to start talking maybe necessarily about politics right off the hop.
Right. You know, politics would be something you ease into. And if you do want to talk because something very important happened globally, you can put it in the middle of a sentence in a prepositional phrase. That way you're signaling a person. If they don't pick it up, you move on to the next thing. But really, you do talk about small talk items, the event, the venue, the sponsor, the food. You start with little things. Where are you from? Are you originally from here? Many people have moved from place to place, so you might find out that you're at a place in Montreal, but someone might have been born in Singapore. You just don't know. So if you start with that kind of what we call small talk, it invariably leads to the big talk. But that's how we learn about people, and it's also how we learn those points of connections that we have in common.
Susan, how do you avoid coming off as being fake or, you know, uncomfortably conversing? Because I feel like that is a concern for so many of us who maybe deem ourselves as shy. And, you know, you are trying to schmooze, for lack of a better term, and make a good impression. I think a lot of people are always fearful of maybe being too much when talking to the bosses or people that could help them.
Well, you know, I think when we're talking to bosses or people that could help us, we want to be aware that there is, you know, there's still the boss, etc. But if you're comfortable in your own skin, and again, if you turn to make that person comfortable then that works better for you. A lot of people assume that the boss or the people that can help them are comfortable. No, 90% of them are shy too. So if you are just polite, appropriate, conversant, this is not the time to ask them certainly for a raise or for a new position. But if you miss the opportunity of talking to that person in a more casual situation, believe me, you'll regret it. So it's important to say something rather than nothing.
And do you, you know, when you're speaking with them, again, you know, with casual topics, is it very important for you to become the listener in a way? Because, you know, you often hear that people like to talk about themselves.
Well, I think there's a balance. There are people who seem like they never listen, but there are people who went to that school of thought of all we have to do is ask questions and let people talk about themselves. I would caution against that. When you do that, people will invariably they'll talk, but they could be resentful because it sounds like you're prying, you're interrogating. So it's a balance. It's asking questions, it's sharing information, it's making observations. But the bottom line is if you don't listen to what people are saying, you won't know what to talk about because often someone will make a comment and that's the direction you should pick up because that's what they're interested in. So listening is crucial. But if all you do is listen and you don't contribute, you're not in a conversation.
Now, something I wanted to ask you about with regards to me, I'm going to use myself as an example. Last week, I actually had to go to an industry event with regards to a CD launch, and I was happy to be there, but I didn't know anyone except for my friend that I had brought with me. Now, I kind of use that as an example because I know that I am not necessarily comfortable just launching into conversation with people, even though I am a radio announcer. So I found it interesting in the fact that I didn't even really know where to start, because a bunch of these people I knew were probably people I should talk to just, you know, to get to know, especially around my city that I might cross paths with them again, especially in the industry that I'm in. I didn't know how to launch into it because I didn't know really anyone except for the people that invited me.
Well, you know what? And this is the exact situation so many of us find that we're in. So I'm glad you mentioned it. What you do is you know who you are, you know why you're invited. The easiest thing to do is to go over to someone standing alone. And I'll tell you why. Believe me, they feel uncomfortable if they're standing alone. I don't know if the event has name tags, but sometimes the name tags will give you some hint. Just say, oh, I see you're here. How did you get invited? Is this your first time at this particular venue? I mean, it starts with little small talk. Go over to the person alone. Generally, they'll be so happy that you came over to them, they will feel welcomed. The second thing is, sometimes we walk into an event and we see people in groups and we're thinking, oh my gosh, everyone's already talking to each other. Go over to a group that has four or five people. Sometimes when we go to an event with someone, we only talk to that person. And you know what? Honestly, you really did need, like you said, to meet some of the people in your industry. It takes, I guess, a lot of courage. Take a deep breath and go over to that group that has four or five people that look like they're having a good time. You can stand in the periphery, and when someone acknowledges you, you can say something agreeable. Step into the conversation. But if you go to an event and you only talk to the person you came with or stand alone, why even go? And that's why I want people to be comfortable, know how to work a room, know how to meet people, and know how to exit conversations, because that's equally important.
I want to speak to you about that in a second as well. And I'm glad that we were talking about this specific example, because I felt like an island unto myself at this event, because there was, like, I would say maybe 40, 50 people at the event. So it wasn't that big. And there was little pockets of groups, you know, around this bar area, this lounge that we were at. And I felt like it was the Great Wall of China. Like, I didn't know how to, like, again, get in there. I mean, eventually I did sort of end up seeing someone I knew, and then she introduced me to someone else. So it started that way and things sort of worked out well. And actually, to be honest with you, the friend that I brought with me, I brought her with me on purpose because she is great in social settings. And I knew that even though she wasn't even in my industry, she would start talking to someone and probably it would help me out. And sure enough, that's what happened. But I know I can't be relying on friends like that. It was like an island unto myself, and it was hard to get there and open things up.
And it is hard. And what you just did was really smart. And to all our listeners, if you have a friend that is good at doing this, by all means, bring a friend. But the other part is sometimes we aren't invited with someone else. We're invited alone. So that's why we really have to prepare, have our self-introduction. read the paper, listen to radio, know what's going on in your own community. I mean, people do talk about movies and books and celebrities and sports. And how about this? You know what else? We talk about food. So if they're serving food, there is someone that's going to talk to you about the chocolate cake at the dessert table or the sushi at the special appetizers. So really, sometimes the talk is about things going on in the venue. But if we don't go into a room thinking we're going to meet some potentially interesting people, and that goes back to what you first said about attitude. This one is go everywhere thinking, oh, wow, who am I going to get to meet? Instead of, oh, my God, who am I going to have to meet?
That's a good thing to have in your head. I think that's perfect because that's how I actually felt when I went to this event. It was like I knew I needed to go. I knew it was going to be beneficial for me to go. But I was like very trepidatious about it because I am not good when I don't know people and I have to do it that way. So go on. Sorry.
Bringing
Susan.
A wingman or a wingwoman is brilliant. In fact, I remember I had a friend who was single when I was married. She brought me to events so I could help introduce her to single men. It really worked very well.
That's fantastic. And Susan, you were talking, you know, about exiting a conversation. How do you do that?
Well, you know, there are three ways to exit. If you've had a great conversation with someone, but you know, you can observe they're kind of ready to meet other people in the room. We don't ever want to be the person that hogs people's time. So what you do is you observe them, but what you say to them is, oh, you interrupt yourself, not them, and say, you know, it was so nice to talk to you about, and in one little phrase, summarize what you're talking about so they know you were listening. And then if it's time to exchange cards, you may ask, oh, do you have a card? And if you promise to send them something, an article or whatever, we have to do that. If they don't ask for your card, it's very fair to say with the most polite, oh, may I offer you one of mine? And then what you do, you must walk a quarter of the room away from the person. If you stand in the same space, it looks like you turned your back. So that's one way, but that's when you've had a really nice conversation. Now, I have a friend who, oh, she is so charming. I love being with her. I watched her do this. Brilliant. She'll talk to someone for a couple of minutes, and she says, oh, I'm having such a good time talking to you. You know, I could really monopolize all your time, but I know that you need to meet other people, and other people want to meet you.
Wow.
And you know what? I haven't been able to pull that off yet, but I thought, it's fun, it's kind, it's true, because she's the kind of person that couldn't monopolize you, but she's so sensitive to the fact that people come there to meet more than one person. And she makes people feel good as she's exiting them. And what she's great at is if she says that there'll be any follow-up, immediately she does what she says she's going to do the next day. But that's one way. Another thing is if you're talking to someone, and let's just say, Kelly, they're not interesting to talk to. They seem so distracted, almost to the point of being cold. It could be that there's nothing to do with you, that they just maybe got some bad news from the family, from career, etc., and they're distracted. So we must never be rude, no matter how it appears that they are rude. You still put out your hand, and instead of saying, it was wonderful talking to you, big smile on your face, you say, oh, I hope you enjoy the rest of the event. Because the next time you see them, everything could be fine. And if you were equally rude to them, they will only remember your rudeness, not how they were. But you still walk a quarter of the room away, over to another person standing alone or a group with three or four people.
And you mentioned, you know, about the business cards and the exchange of that. Can you please explain this? Because I think this is a very key element when you're, you know, doing the schmooze.
Well, and by the way, schmooze is exactly what we call it. Let me define it. Schmooze is easygoing, connected, friendly conversation. There's some people that think it's about getting what you want. That isn't it. It's that easygoing conversation. And when you want someone's business card, I always think the language of politeness and manners is the best. Oh, do you have a card? Or you could say, may I have one of your cards? And that way, who's going to say to you, actually, I'm going to give them to other people and not to you? I mean, people are generally going to give you a card. And this is not the time, and because how we do it in the West is different than the East, this is not the time to put the card in your pocket. You look at the card and give it the honor by looking at the name of the company, and make a comment before you put it in a card case, etc. And, you know, may I offer you one of mine? It's an exchange. It differs in different countries. The customs differ. But always there's a custom, and it's always about being polite. And as long as we make sure that we honor people's cards and look at them, because they'll provide us information for conversation as well, that really helps us. And guess what? It helps us remember the person we talk to.
Okay, fantastic. Joining us on the show is keynote speaker and best-selling author Susan Rowan. Check her out on her website, susanrowan.com. Now, what are your big no-nos to stay away from when trying to make your mark at a workplace function?
First of all, the bar. No, you can have the requisite one drink. At a workplace function, I don't care if it's a no-host bar, this is not the place to show how well you can hold your liquor, because most likely you can't. So I know I hate to be a killjoy, but be very careful about giving the impression that you're good at drinking at a business event. Also, in terms of food, I'd stay away from anything with garlic. It does impact conversations. The other thing to do is, this is not the time to reveal too much about yourself that is personal. You can reveal a little bit here, ask a little bit there, but remember, it's still about business. And even though it might look social, with a band and with food and with a theme and entertainment, if it's sponsored by any kind of business group, it's business. And remember, it can impact your career.
Susan, you have been fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'd love to, and I'm happy to come to any country, any city, and talk about the subject.
Excellent. Thank you. That is keynote speaker and best-selling author Susan Rowan. Make sure to check her out, susanrowan.com. so much for joining us on this very special edition of the Kelly Alexander Show as we took a look back at some of the very cool people and interesting topics that we talked about over the last several months right here on the show. I want to give a big shout out to my technical producer Esteban Vargas for putting all the magic together. And before I go, I want to leave you in a very positive frame of mind for the week ahead. This quote comes from Martin Luther: "Faith is permitting ourselves to be seized by the things we do not see." Have a great week. If you have any comments or questions, Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. You and I'll chat soon.